You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Eric Stenner Carlson is the author of the St. Perpetuos Club of Buenos Aires, Maladonna, the story collection Dark Arts, and The Pear Tree Is Torture Ever Justified. His new collection of stories is Tales from the Coming War. Thank you for joining me, Eric.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here again.
You know, if you read your book, happiness just seems to be a fleeting emotion in the world you create. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the Pear Tree, just in terms of setting this up, because as I read that, I realized what a giant influence it has in your ability to create the works in this story, Stories from the Coming War. You were in for the International Criminal Court for the former Yugoslavia. Tell us a bit about that job. What brought you there? How did you get that job? It's like something you go apply for down at the local office.
Yeah, sure. And I think it really does. And I think it's great we mentioned it because it's part of my life story, and it certainly impacts my writing. And I think this whole sense that certainly I write in terms of fantastic and fiction and ghost stories, etc. But it's, I think when a lot of my readers say it seems so real, even though we're talking about fantastic things, because I ground it in things that are real. For a long time, I was a human rights activist or advocate. I studied human rights, international relations, and it was actually before my kind of journey started in that, before I went to the criminal tribunal, I interned for a summer with the Argentine team of forensic archaeologists in Argentina to help exhume bodies of the disappeared people, people who'd been murdered by the military government in the 60s, late 70s and early 80s. And because of the work I'd done there and the work I'd done on human rights, I worked for the criminal tribunal for the former Yugoslavia with a great group called Physicians for Human Rights. So I was what's called seconded. I was brought in by Physicians for Human Rights to work on, you know, one of the most terrible war crimes, which is mass sexual assault during war. And it was a really foundational experience for me in terms of how I consider myself as a human being. It shook. We've talked about this before. Spirituality is extremely important for me. The idea of God and God's love is very important for me. And that whole experience very much shook me to the core of myself as a spiritual person. And I think those sorts of terrible experiences show up in my work because if God's love is overwhelming, what we do sometimes in God's name is overwhelming in a totally different way. It's horrifying. And I think that's this book is about this war in the future. And I think the worst thing we can do, the most horrifying, you don't need a horror movie for this, the most horrifying thing we do as human beings is making war.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed throughout my life is that almost every day seems like it's part of the end days. And I think that's a kind of almost a universal human trait. You look around and think, this can't last. It's something terrible is going to happen. And I think that's one of the things you capture in this book is both the sense that everything's about to fall apart and simultaneously the feeling that everything has fallen apart, and that we've experienced what Stanislaw Lem called the apocalypse, which is the apocalypse that came but went unnoticed in the general haste. And I think that between this idea of the end days and the idea of the apocalypse that has already come to pass. Your novel or your collection of stories is right in the center of that and captures both those perceptions that are somewhat conflicting. Talk about the conflict for you between the end that is coming and the end that has already arrived.
No, thank you very much. You know, it's funny. I got a shout out to Ray Russell, the fantastic, and Ray Rosalie, fantastic editors, publishers at Tartarus Press. They're absolutely amazing. And I had many really interesting discussions with Ray. For example, the current preface is very much focused on the human experience, which this book is, you know, science fiction. It's about war and lots of things, AI, etc. But it's really about people's last moments, and it's moments of transformation, realization, and reflection on their lives. And I think, you know, and I've been talking back and forth with Ray about this for quite a while. And my first intro was very much about AI and machines and things like that. And I realized that wasn't the real story. The real story was that those ultimate and very intimate moments. And I think we as physical human beings in this material world, we'll all die. And whether it's during warfare or crossing the street and getting hit by a cab or through some disease or something or in warfare, we will find those last moments. And it's when we think about those loved ones of ours who've passed or friends we know, it comes down to very, very simple things, you know, like I'm sorry for having done such and such, or I wish I could have another day to listen to the rain. I mean, these are things that are so emotive in us. And I think when one person dies, their whole world dies with them. And so we're accompanying these 13 characters, and they're you know, the way I write, we've talked about this before. I mean, I live with these characters. They're not people I create. Even if they do things that are wrong or I consider evil or good or whatever, I live with them. They're very much my friends, and I try to look at them without judgment. I think of them in those last moments. Some characters, it's not their last day, perhaps, but it's their last day of being who they were. And then they have this great opportunity and a terrifying opportunity to be something other than what they were up to that point. And I think the idea of transformation is extremely important for me as a person, and I think also in writing.
Early on, you mentioned this. Let me just read this out of the book. Augenblick, the blinking of an eye. In that instant, all other human interaction fades to nothingness, which is the prelude to everything. And I think you capture the meaning of that in these stories so beautifully. Talk about, you know, that using an instant to capture a lifetime.
Well, thanks. You know, it's funny. I like words. I like books. I may even love words. I think about words all the time. I've always not just disliked math. I hate math. I can't think like math. I think in terms of stories and narratives. And the word Augenblick in German, I'd studied in my German's pretty poor right now, but I studied in Austria for a while and studied German there. And that idea of the what we would call, like, you know, the moment, something momentary or transitory, Augenblick is the blinking of an eye. And I think that really is something about that instantaneous, whether we see the person with whom we're going to spend the rest of our lives, and we see that love in that instant, or we come to that realization that we've been on the path that we shouldn't be on for many, many years, and we see that in an instant. And I think there's something very much about that in I See Minsa that also plays with the idea of a person, and I won't ruin the story, but a person who hasn't been seen. Minsa hasn't been seen throughout the whole story, and yet she's been seen throughout the whole story. So, you know, that realization by the character comes in an Augenblick, comes in the blinking of an eye, and that is the most it's transitory, but it's the most transformational moment. And I think everyone goes to that Augenblick experience in the book. And I think we do as human beings. I reflect myself. Again, we may talk about ghosts or a war that hasn't occurred or a love story that between people that at least don't walk on this earth. But there's something real about that because it's something real in the human experience. We come to these moments where it's a bit like the crossroads. We know the devil works at the crossroads. And we have that moment to go left or right or up or down. I think also personal choice is extremely important for me as a writer. I think the lowest level of hell, as Dante said, was reserved for those who didn't make a choice. And they didn't either go to betray or they didn't go to defend. I'm actually reading, it was a book I stayed away from for a long time. I'm reading Milton's Paradise Lost. And that whole idea of the fall, constantly go through a fall. I don't think there's one fall, but we're fallen as people. But at certain flash points, we get up. And there's something about the human ability to make a decision about where our life was going and where we want to go in a new direction. So, I mean, you know, I'm as you said about happiness, as with myself, I'm not sure I have a lot of happiness. I've found moments of great joy and moments of great depression. These are very peak moments. But I think they're these moments where we can recognize ourselves in them and change happens in an instant.
They are moments of great humanity when we realize all of the possibilities and potentialities that we contain, good and bad. You know, one of the things I think that I love about this book is the sensibility, because given the title, one might think, you know, it's coming war, there's going to be a lot of science fiction and robots or whatever. And I think that what you do is use the elements of the fantastic to just, you're an absolute master, virtuoso, of using them to extract and talk about what's happening right now and make us feel, even in these really unfamiliar places and worlds, that you're reaching deep into our souls. So talk about using the elements of the fantastic, and use it in such an interesting manner, because you mix up the science fiction and the fantasy and the superstition, all so they're all congealed as one human problem, generally.
Well, I don't quite know how to answer that. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, I look at the world like that. When I lived in Argentina, I love what we call folklore, mythology, and there in Argentina, people can pretty much say, like, okay, this is what the accepted faith is, whether it's Christianity or others, and then there's this other, which is the witches and werewolves and things like that. And there's this very firm line between what is the approved spiritual and then what is the other spiritual. It's also very scary. But having worked in Thailand and Southeast Asia for a long time, there's so many interwoven lives that it's very difficult to say what is the approved, if there is such a thing, approved spirituality, and what is the otherness. And I think there's a sense of, I think for me, and when there's a quote that I used in Dark Arts for one of the short stories. I loved you, your darkest. Well, when these two men are talking about the relationship and there's this joke they hold between, the saying they hold between them, and you don't really hear the full answer until the end of the story. When one says, what would happen if you asked Vikings if they believed in dragons? And the other answers, they would think it's ridiculous because they see dragons all the time. It would be like asking, do you believe in the sky? Mm-hmm. Do you believe in lightning? Of course I do. And I guess I see dragons all the time. I see this when I've talked to people who've committed human rights violations, and I've talked to people who have been the victims and then transformed themselves, again, a transformative movement, into the survivor of that torture, that mistreatment. I see human beings. And it's very difficult for me to close off that valve of empathy. I never would support or defend people who commit outrageous acts and acts of violence, but I very much understand them at a human level, because if you look at any perpetrator, you'll see a child who was hurt. So there's this mixture of the good and the bad and the profane and the saintliness and the dragon-like and the everyday of paying taxes and getting a newspaper and all this stuff. I very much see that world as one. It's a very, I mean, maybe that's just kind of how I see the world.
You know, one of the things I love about the way you write in this book, and here's another clip from one of your stories. I'm delirious. My mind's trying to piece together fragments, things I imagine. When I was cleaning up your papers, I saw a bill that you paid to that place. And I think one of the things that this is that interests me is that this passage gives a good example of your ability to have our made up perceptions collude and collide and collapse with the reality, you know, the things we can touch around us. So talk about exploring that in your fiction, and also the effect of this kind of collapsing reality has on your characters and on yourself as a writer. I mean, you have been there in those places where reality has, in a sense, collapsed.
I think that's really interesting. I spent that quote was from Desertscape, and I thought about that a lot. And I'm trying to think of the right word. It's not being vague, but it's there are things that happen in all the stories, which I'm not really sure, and I think the reader's not really sure what exactly is the truth, what exactly is going on, you know. And the fragment you read, which is about this young man finding the truth. He goes to these papers of his father, and he finds the truth, but it's ambiguous. I think that's the ambiguity. And there's something about that ambiguity in day-to-day life that's also kind of horrifying, because we want straight answers. And you know, Hannah Arendt comes up in my book, and I didn't reference was the, you know, that sort of when she was talking about the Eichmann trial, and she was talking about evil and how the evil is just part of the common, you know, this common thread. It's not something, oh, it's the boogeyman out there or some sort of caricature. There's this something lurking in humanity. And I didn't mention this before, but you know, that this alliance, this reference to the alliance, pops up many times in most, if not all, the stories. And all the characters are on different sides of the alliance. And we're not really sure, is the alliance good or bad? Because every single character commits an act of cruelty. And every single character receives an act of cruelty. And so in the end, although we talk, it's about the tales of the coming war, and they have this alliance and mentions political and military things going on. It really reduces it down, I think, to that human level, where whatever they've done, whatever allegiances they've had, this is it. This is it. And they've got to come to terms with that. And they have to, and as you know, the stories are very much about relationships. It's less about, and thinking about, thinking about my story, Letter to My Husband, which is a story that I can't read myself without crying, because it's too overwhelming, the relationship between the two scientists, a man and a wife. And she has this moment of realization where she says that, I would have thought that of all the awful things we've done in warfare and all the awful things done to us, that would be the thing that shocks me the most. But it's this intimate, familiar, very close, very in your house, in your family, in your marriage relationship, those tiny, supposed tiny acts of betrayal that in the end are the most extreme and the most powerful. Because I can't control that. I can't control the alliance. I can't control what happens. I can't control if my house will be bombed or not. But that very thing that I could control, which is fidelity or love or caring or that word that I could have used, I didn't. And for that one character in Letter to My Husband, that was one of those Augenblick moments. She realizes that in an instant. And she feels, even though she can't undo it or make up for it, she will write it. And I think that's also an influence of my work in human rights advocacy, and why I turned from working with the dead and on justice to tell the story for the deceased, because I wanted to work with the living. I wanted to work with great people all around the world who live with HIV, great people around the world who have disabilities or perceived as having disabilities, great people who struggle against so many different acts of stigma and discrimination, friends of mine in the gay and trans community. I want to work there because we have an opportunity to change the narrative. Actually, that was I edited a collection many years ago with people who either had worked on HIV or were living with HIV themselves. And I remember very powerful, and they said it, you know, I'm supposed to be this great writer, et cetera. This one gentleman said it much better than I could have ever said, so these aren't my words, was he said, Eric, we are here to change the story. Estamos acá para cambiar la historia. And I think that was such a great moment, because I thought we are here to change the story. If we see things in our own lives that are going the direction we don't want to, if we're repeating patterns from our parents or our grandparents, and we realize that in the moment, we have the opportunity to make a change. So that's kind of, I don't know if that kind of answers your question, that kind of goes to what I have at the top of my mind.
Well, you know, when you were talking about repeating patterns, it made me think of something that about one of the great and oldest supernatural tropes, which is the ghosts. And I think one of the reasons that that supernatural tropes and science fiction tropes are so powerful is because they evoke directly the human within us. And we all like to think of ghosts or, images, see-through images of the dead, so to speak. But the real ghosts that haunt us every day are the mistakes that we have made in the past, the things that we have done that we regret, the things that we did not do that we regret. And I think that's what the power of this book is. And also, too, because the collection covers, it's really multifaceted. It's set in all these different places, and it has a very global feel to it. Talk about creating the global feel. Was that done deliberately from story to story? Or, which is to say, do the settings of the story come before or after the characters and the character conflicts that drive them?
Yeah, that's could I make sure that I don't forget that part? I want to go to something you just said about this human nature. You know, our brains are wired to remember all our mistakes, because in evolution, that's what keeps us alive. You know, mm-hmm. If I almost stepped in the lion's den, my brain tells me you're stupid, you're awful, you should remember that because you want, you know, you want to survive. We seldom, and also when teaching, people oftentimes dwell on the things that did wrong instead of things that did right. But it was on the nature of this being so human. I have many of my obsessions. I'm obsessed about Armenia. And there's this great prayer book by St. Gregory of Nadik. It was written about 1,000 years ago. And because I only visited Armenia once, but I have many Armenian friends in Argentina. And he has this beautiful, I read that prayer book every night. I have it, it's next to my bed. And I feel his prayers are so current, even though they're written 1,000 years ago. And he has this great prayer where he says, like, the man is at the plow with his handle, with his hands on the handle, like he's about to go forward. And yet he thinks about the mistakes of the past. And I love that image that came 1,000 years ago, that we're here at the plow and we've got work to do and we have creative work to do and we're going forward and we're gonna break the earth and we're gonna heal and we're gonna plant. But I'm thinking back into the things I've done wrong. And I think a lot of these characters are doing that and hence their moment. I think you asked about, so I just want to say that. I think you asked about this international feeling. I love different cultures and languages. I especially love languages I can't understand because they sound so beautiful and otherworldly. One of the famous languages, favorite languages I have is because I can understand some of it, is Sephardic, Ladino, also called Ladino language, that has, it's like ancient Spanish, but then it can throw in Latin, Greek, Bulgarian, Hebrew, and different words. And it's like listening to a language in a dream. You know, when you're in a dream and you can understand everything, you wake up and you can't remember what that was. So there are 13 different stories with 13 different locations. And many of them, if not all of them, I've actually been to these countries or places. People always ask me, do you start, you know, I know each story has to have a big beginning, middle, and end, but I often start it. I know exactly what the end is, or I know the middle, or it comes to me in dreams, and then I piece it together. But it's, I think I have this real love for difference and diversity. And when I go to different countries, like the Chronicle, one of the extremely special experience I had was this trip to the Faroe Islands. That's where it's based. And it was right after COVID, during COVID and kind of towards the end of COVID. And I remember I was so afraid to travel. And a friend of mine said, you've been dreaming about going to Faroe Islands for years. Don't let your fear stop you. And I went to the Faroe Islands and I had this an amazing series of moments. But there's this one time I was basically alone on one of the many, I can't remember now how many islands they have, there's 20 some islands. And I was walking, I just come on a ferry in the fog, and it was windy, and the island was so high that I actually could see, I was above birds flying below me. And as I turned through a mountain path, it must have been perfectly a perfect barrier with the rocks, that there was a lull and there was an absolute silence. An absolute silence. I couldn't hear the birds or the sheep or the waves. And there was just a moment that could only have come to me by going to Faroe Islands in that exact, on that day and in that exact moment. So I feel a lot of things when I go to different countries and speak to different people. I never intentionally use people's words and put them in the mouths of my characters. My characters speak, and then I have to listen to see if I understood what they said. But certainly this idea that, again, also for this international war, I wanted that human experience be reflected in every country, because it is. You have so many belt buckles that are terrible. From World War II, you see this Gott mit uns, God with us. People would put on military supplies. They would say God is with us. And people on the other side of the war we're saying God is with us as well. And maybe because
that's not
I have,
a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign.
On both sides, he's like an arms dealer.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the things we do in the name of God or gods is so terrible. And I think that's what warfare really is. And I think about, because I have anxiety and OCD, I sometimes think God is sad. You know, I never think of God as vengeful or jealous or evil or vindictive in any way. I think of God as pure love, a love I could never even conceptualize. And I could only think that he or she or they or the Great Spirit would view with sadness what we do, the fact that we think God is with us. And I think the answer actually is that belt buckle is correct in the sense that God is with us, loves us, wants us to do the best we can, but God is not with us to destroy. God is not with us to carry out warfare. I think these are these moments that I come from the Lutheran tradition that hell is not a place of fire and molten lava and torture. Hell is when we turn our back on God. And I think that's people use, I think by using God's name to do terrible things, they're turning away from God. When a lot of the characters, several of the characters have this opportunity to turn towards God, whatever, and again, whatever God they believe in, if it's the universe, or if it's nature, or it's that love that they lost with someone dear to them, some of them turn towards that in their last moment. And I think, you know, when Gandhi was assassinated, his last words were, "Oh God."
You mentioned the Story Chronicle, which I thought was really beautifully done. And it takes place, you know, kind of like in the deep past and maybe the near future. Talk about creating this chronicle, which is based, as you say, on some of your reading. This is the story that was set in the Faroe Islands. It's just beautifully written. And for some reason, to me, it just struck me as really evocative of, you know, that kind of rainy day feeling.
Well, thank you. I there are a couple of stories that, you know, it's science fiction, but you've got this and also Christ Mammoth. It goes to the past and then it goes to the future. It's combined. And for Chronicle, when you read these, it can be Norse sagas. Or it could be things that are more contemporary, but still like fables or the Grimm brothers. And there are these stories that sometimes there's this lack of, you know, we want to have this moral, and you read some of these stories and there's no moral whatsoever, but yet the narrator is sure that it's a moral story. And you think like, what did I learn from this? Why would we teach children this story? Why did they write this down? And sometimes I find that some of the narrators, you know, when the narrators are, what do they call them? Untrustful narrators. But sometimes it's just like there's this, I was playing with the fact that there's this undertone or this second level going on in the first narration, because it's narrated by this supposed monk. And he says, he talks about all these horrible things and praises people for doing these horrible things. And it's a lot about gender stereotyping, and it's a lot about warfare. And he's just going on in this. But there's like this subtext going on the whole time where I think he's kind of very cheeky, because he says like, you know, I won't tell you all the deprivations I suffered to get to this island, but I felt like Job being swallowed by the whale. But I won't tell you that. I won't say how difficult it was, but he does. And he says, it's a bit like methinks he doth protest too much. He goes on and supports these outrageous claims and outrageous things. And he says, what I'm about to say goes against it, all this awful stuff. And he talks about this mythology that I created there. But he's saying, I'm just mentioning it just to have it for the record, but I don't believe in it. But isn't that ambiguity? I'm wondering the whole time, did he really believe in this? Does he really believe that? And it's this same story And because I lived in Chile and in Chiloé, I met some excellent, really had some really, really excellent friends from the Mapuche community. And the word, the Selkie they use in the Faroe Islands, of the women who are who shed the seal skin and they dance on the beach, it's the same story in Chiloé, which is all the way south and to the west coast of Chile, instead of all the way north past Scotland to the Faroe Islands. So I wanted to bring in elements of that story that really connects, because everyone's on different sides of the alliance and they're all doing, they may have different political opinions, but they're all connected by this deeper feeling, this deeper narrative. And so it was nice to play with this, to play with this story and chronicle, and then have the second half of the chronicle. We don't know who's telling the second half. We know there's a supposed monk who's telling the first half and saying this very, you know, he wants to use it for political and religious reasons. But the second half, there's this almost omniscient narrator. I don't know if it's the little boy who is the narrator of the story. Sometimes I think it is. He is telling an alternative chronicle. So that's its interplay. It's the past and the future, and it's this kind of, and the boy's very cheeky. He's probably as openly cheeky as the monk is subliminally cheeky.
Well, you know, it makes me think too that because you have these characters who are enveloped in self-conflict and telling their stories, that the point isn't necessarily one side or other of the conflict. The point is the ability to tell a story, a narrative, to in fact become a narrator. And I think that's the transformation that you as a writer accomplish and try to accomplish and achieve. So talk about, you know, the transformational effect of becoming a narrator, of telling a story, even if that story puts you in a place where you have to say things that are on the opposite side.
That's great. I was thinking of what, Roses, for example, my story Roses, and it's about a man who has alopecia, and I have alopecia, and I could talk a bit about some of my own experiences. It's not me in the story, but I could talk with more authenticity about his experience. And at one point he's talking, he is writing, it's a letter. So he's writing to his friend Andros, and he's saying, I can give you the truth. And it says in the good book, the truth shall set you free. But I'm not so sure about that. What I can give you is a truth. It's more like a truth commission rather than a war crimes tribunal. And there I was talking right there. That's kind of a self-portrait.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, justice and social justice is always contextually based. You know, what you and I in this talk right now, we could come up with an idea of justice and what is justice and what is not justice. And so that only really makes sense within we can have a universal sense of justice, but you and I could share or construct a sense of justice. That's different than putting someone on the dock. That's different than judging them. And I, even though when the characters just do awful things, some of the awful things in the story, I'm not supporting them for doing something awful, but I'm looking at them without judgment. Perhaps it's also a reflection of my conception of God. I really think of God as less as the creator and less as the judge, and more of that you know, great narrator who accompanies us. But everyone has to tell their own story in these stories for them to be free. And I think very much again, I don't know if there's stories that are closer to your heart in from the collection or not. I think quite frequently about Letter to My Husband. She needs to write her story. That's the only thing actually that's left for her to tell, to do. She can't control anything else. She can't control the past. She can't control even the present, the future. The only thing she can do is tell the story. And that story may never be heard by anyone. but she is compelled to do it. It's not a compulsion, it's an obsession and compulsion. She's compelled because that is the only way to express her experience. So in some sense, it doesn't matter if there's an audience. She needs that to tell that story for herself. And that for me, that is that also that Augenblick moment. Of course, as writers, and that's what I love being. Well, I love talking to you. You're very kind, and you're a very nice person, and you read my books very closely. So it's great to have a conversation with you. You know, we as writers, we have this extremely kind of alienating, isolating experience where you live with a writer with our characters inside our heads for years, and I still live with all the characters I've ever created in my head forever. And it's this very strange moment where it's a complete closed experience. And then when people like you read the book and we have experience, they come alive. We can talk about these characters. I don't know if on my ego level I need an audience, but to justify my existence. But a book is written to be read. And transmit, and I want to have as many conversations as possible about the books because I learn a lot from readers. They come back and say, "Well, why did you do this?" And I was like, "I have no idea why I did that." And they say, "Don't you think this could imply such and such?" And I was like, "I didn't even think about it. You're right. I didn't even know about that." So I love that conversation. The book is just actually a starting point for a conversation, you know?
You mentioned falling into the past and the present. Christ Mammoth is such a wonderful story, such a powerful example of a certain kind of narrative. You know, you're probably the only person who has ever done this, but reading that story was like falling into a telescope that becomes a microscope, and you just go through. It was really an interesting experience to read it. And then at the very end, you know, you come out as a bright dot in your own eye. And I thought that was a really amazing piece of writing. It was, I think, what would people call maybe a bravura piece of writing? Did you write that in a fury?
It's so funny because some stories just, you know, came to me in dreams, or I knew how they were going to be, and it was, you know, it was just a matter of again, I've said this before, like there's an express train, I just have to keep up with it, or it's a war going on, I just have to write it as I see it. And others, you know, there are always some sort of moments of technique and thinking, should it be a comma or semicolon? And I don't like that part of writing. Christ Mammoth is a very strange story. It's a very strange story because it's a, you know, I like stories within stories within stories within stories. And this is just one that kind of blew my mind. Because there's a narratives happening at all different levels throughout the whole story. I love Professor Radcliffe. He's one of my favorite characters, not because I wrote him, but because I met him through this story. And I won't ruin it, but the part about where the second half of the story delves into the past, that came to me first, and it came to me actually in, I actually didn't even put it in the scene, but when the centurion goes east, I imagined him going to a market in India, and I was overwhelmed with the idea of spices and smells and colors, and thinking it was a wedding day and elephants with chalk drawings on them. And I had this sense of him going through the marketplace. Actually, that story began with that sensation that I had of him, which is doesn't even appear actually as detailed in the story. But I got that sense of where he was coming from, and then why, and the mammoth that appears there. The mammoth is fundamental, even though references the mammoth, what the mammoth means and what it is. That was where I started with. And then I had to take the journey back and figure out what did this mean? And what does this mean to the professor today? So it was really nice what you said about going through a telescope and then falling through the microscope. Without you having known that phrase, that's what happened to me, or maybe not down the rabbit hole, but it was almost like an inverse experience.
Exactly. Like
I knew how it was going to be kind of the denouement, but I didn't know how we got there. But I just had to accompany my characters back in a time machine, basically, to figure out where they were. And then I watched them, and then I was like, okay, now I understand. Now they revealed it to me.
You mentioned dreams a couple of times. As it happens, I engineer a radio show about dreams and provide an ambient.
You mentioned that. That's so interesting.
I provide an ambient soundtrack every week for an hour long. But so talk about dreams. Do you keep a dream journal?
I don't keep a dream journal. We talked before about dark arts and how, especially when I had COVID, and the long COVID and all the bizarre dreams and talking about things that connected us throughout the world. You know, we could be on totally different sides of the planet, different political affiliations, religious convictions, etc. But we're all having these bizarre COVID dreams. You know, but dreams have always been important for me as a child. I think there was a defense mechanism. I never liked. I came across I was rereading the Bible, and for colleagues who are listening in, I don't think, you know, whatever spirituality or way you have of reaching God or the good or whatever is, I'm not judgmental. You know, that was kind of my framework. So that just is just something that works for me. But when I was rereading the Bible, and there's this part, I think it's Book of John, where Jesus of Nazareth says, if you were of this world, they would love you, but you're not of this world. I think there's a difference between the earth and the world. The earth is us going out now and going to the lake in Geneva, or going to the forest and having a cup of coffee and talking about our family and our work and all this stuff. That's the earth. The world is everything else that's been constructed around us that's supposed to be, you know, that pretends to separate us. And I think very much dreams for me were always to go to the earth, and to you know, flying dreams, dreams where I could be free, and I could kind of shut myself off from this. And you see you see this, and this may, you know, be no surprise. The story that takes place in Buenos Aires in my collection about the woman who dreams about the woman on the rocking chair in the mountains who dreams of us. So dreams are incredibly important for me. Again, as a defense mechanism, but I'll share a dream that I had recently, and it was I was sleeping, and it was a dream of my spirit, and this spirit grabbed onto my hands. Okay, and it was an elderly woman, and she grabbed onto my hands. I physically could hear her. I could feel her grab. It wasn't like an ethereal or a dream like things, but it was a connection. And you know, I asked her what she wanted, and I tried to give her some words of comfort, and it was a very immediate. You know, my dreams are very, definitely not about unicorns and bunnies and rainbows, but there's something about connecting to something else beyond there. And I do believe there's something there, and I think sometimes we can tap into that. Sometimes we're oblivious to it. I don't have a magic door. Oh, have you ever read the story? Sorry, The Door in the Wall by H.G. Wells.
No, I have not.
It is one of my favorite all-time stories, and it has nothing to do with aliens coming from outer space. It has nothing to do with scientific experiments. It's an absolutely beautiful story, and your listeners may look it up and say, that's not H.G. Wells. I think it's H.G. Wells. Anyway, it's about a man who every time there's a major life decision, whether it's, you know, when he's a little child, he wanders in this magical garden. He comes across, it's like in dreams, you know, when you have a, you thought, well, why did I notice there was a door here? You know? And when he's a child, he opens this door, although he knows he's not supposed to be there, opens it up, and it's this magical, beautiful dream world with leopards and people playing games, and he understands the games, but later on he can't when he wakes up. And then after that, you know, he gets back in this drudgery, this gray, awful, regimented life where he has to go to school and then go into politics and get married and all this stuff. And every time he's at a crossroad after that first experience, he sees the magical door appear and he never takes it. He never takes it. He knows he's about to become, I don't know if it's a prime minister or someone in the government, and he sees the door on the wall appear, he doesn't take it. And then there's a moment at the end where he apparently takes the door on the wall with certain consequences. And I think there's this idea for me that's very prevalent. And it's such a beautiful story of this door on the wall and when it appears to us and when we actually decide to go in or not.
You know, one of the things that you are talking about, the story about the wraiths, and one of the things I really like about the sensibility of this book is that the wraiths are these dark things that come out and snatch people and eat them alive or eat their souls alive. It's somewhat unclear, but the feel of it is that it's this a supernatural entity or is it a weapon of the future? I love that you managed to create a kind of uncertainty that draws us through the story, but by the end of the story, you don't resolve the uncertainty, but we learn to live with it and see both sides of it. And that, I think, is a really important part of your fiction, is to create uncertainty and then let your narrators and your readers learn to live with that uncertainty.
Yeah, and again, the Rose, the story of Roses, when it's the letter writer is actually, he says at one point, he's writing to his childhood companion, childhood, I wouldn't say friend, but someone from his childhood. And he's saying, you're a scientific man, so you understand things in a scientific way. I'm a religious, and you're a modern scientific man, so you understand a certain way. I am an old-fashioned religious man, so I'll understand things in a different way. And actually, the 13 characters in the story, the principal characters, are all understanding it in a different way. So whether it is a wraith or a robot or some sort of genetic experiment or a cyborg or whatever, they're all seeing it in a different way, and yet they're having the same experience.
Human experience, which is what you so excellently capture. I'm wondering, what's next for you?
Well, it's funny. I'm wondering myself, you know, I'm wondering what's next for the world. I'm thinking, you know, more and more, you know, the external world, and the internal world, and you know, writing is an expression of me as a person. So it's not just I put on my writer's hat and I become someone else. This is my 10th book. It's a very personal book. In some ways, you know, dark arts. So, in some ways, it's a companion to dark arts, because in dark arts, I explored kindness, and in Tales from the Future War, I explore cruelty. And they're, you know, I don't think the two halves of the same coin, but there's this thing about kindness and cruelty, and when we're kind to people we love, or cruel to people we love, and vice versa, people we don't love. I have a lot of different ideas and a lot of different directions I'd like to go. And I think, you know, I write novels all the time. I write short stories all the time, many at the same time. So that's kind of how my brain works. I'm writing different narratives, maybe because I live in different narratives in my mind. And at one point, I finally saw after a long time this story, this movie, Wonder Boys, with Michael Douglas. It's a very funny movie, and I remember the line from so many years ago. I think the movie's like 30 years old. One of the characters says, "Writing is about decisions, about taking decisions. You know, you can't have everything." So right now I'm in a moment where I have many different books underway. And I think I may just take the decision to step back and just work on some personal growth and peace. Thinking about the prayer book I mentioned with St. Gregory of Nodik from Armenia, just kind of thinking, can I come to a point for a while at least where I have my hands on the plow and I'm just thinking about plowing? Without thinking back about the things I've done wrong in the past or hurtling ahead. And that's what Mensa is very much about. I see Mensa as very much this character is never really here. They're always somewhere else. And I like that character because maybe that's sometimes I find myself maybe. So as a person, maybe I'd like to take some time to kind of try to be here and see where I'm needed and where I can be with the people I love. And then see where the spirit takes me. Because I'll need to finally make a decision if I, you know, finally finish this book or that book. But I think kind of the universe is telling me, hey, Eric, take some time to work on yourself. And then you can have conversations like this. I mean, it's just lovely to be on your show because I get to hear your ideas and reflect myself and I get to grow a bit more. So if I had all the answers, I definitely wouldn't write, you know, because I think I write also to explore. I ask myself a lot of questions, you know, and this classical question, if there's a good and an omniscient and omnipotent and all loving God, why do horrible things happen? I've kind of shifted from saying, you know, why would God let that happen? And more to why are we doing it? You know, why are we doing it? You know, I have sometimes a very very touching relationship with God when I actually pay attention, because I see God wants us wherever we are to be loved and to be cared for and to care for others. That's certainly something I explore in my books. And I think if the next book can help me ask more of those questions, then that may be a book that maybe may connect to other people as well.
The new book by Eric Stenner Carlson is Tales from the Coming War. Thank you for joining me, Eric.
Oh, thank you. I just had a super pleasure. Thank you for creating, allowing the space, because we need more space for creativity and the arts. And for conversations. Thank you. I really appreciate this moment.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.